To order, let the record show it's 9 a.m. on the dot, February 25th, 2007. At least we don't have a second hand on the old clock, so from here it looks like we're right on the dot.
Yep.
We do have a quorum. With me today is Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas. We are expecting, and myself, Senator Stedman, but we're expecting another one or two senators to come in here that are retained in another meeting. Today we're going to have a discussion on two bills concerning ethics reform. There's a CS for Senate Bill number 19, and then we're going to discuss CS for Senate Bill 20. And with that, I'd like to have Senator French come forward and identify himself for the record. We're going to, again, hear and have a discussion on these two bills. We're going to try to bring them back in an expedited fashion in the next few days, working with the committee members and Senator French on areas within the bill. Senator French, if you could give us an overview on this bill 19, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. My name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate. With me is my staffer, Allison Biostock, who has worked on these bills extensively. If I may, I'll begin with Senate Bill 19. The Senate Bill 19 deals with executive ethics, the laws pertaining to the ethics provisions that govern the executive branch. The bill really is meant to address one central issue, and that is the lack of definition with respect to the size of investment that any executive branch officer may have and still take official action with respect to that investment. The bill lays out a series of provisions that, in a sense, define what it is you can have and not have and still be active in the executive branch, making decisions that may have an impact on that investment. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'll just walk through the bill line by line, and we can I'll be happy to take questions whenever you or the members of the committee are interested in doing so. For the record, the document I'm working from is CS for Senate Bill number 19, the State Affairs CS / Lima. Section 1 takes the old language that defines what a violation is not and reenacts it, because as we worked on the bill both last year and this year, we found the language to be confusing and difficult to understand. And since it's one of the primary portions of the ethics code, it seemed most important to have that clear and understandable, because if you don't get off on the right foot, you're just going to have trouble from there on out. So we rewrote it, and I think it's just worth reading into the record that says subsection A, which is not here, essentially says you have to be you have to be ethical and honest in all your dealings. And then subsection B says, notwithstanding A, all those good things, a public officer's action or influence with respect to the officer's personal or financial interest in a specific matter is not a violation of public trust or a violation of this chapter. So it's not an ethics violation if the public officer's action or influence in the matter would have only an insignificant or conjectural effect on the matter. And let's just stop for a moment there. And what that means is if you have, say you have $1 million of IBM stock, say you're a procurement officer in the executive branch, say you're making a decision to buy a computer, some new computers for for state office buildings, if you are leaning towards a computer system that would trade with IBM, then you'd better get out of that, because that may have a significant or more than conjectural effect on the matter. If, on the other hand, you're contemplating buying a whole suite of Mac computers, Apple computers, that IBM doesn't do any business with, then you're probably okay. But that's the idea. If your decision only has an insignificant or conjectural effect on the matter, then you haven't committed a violation. Subsection 2 on line 12 says, if the public officer's personal or financial interest is of a type that is possessed generally by the public or a large class of persons to which the public officer belongs, And I think there's two examples there that help illustrate what that means. One is, let's just take the permanent fund dividend check as an example. Everyone in the state gets a permanent fund dividend check. If you are an employee of the permanent fund division or department and you're making decisions that will increase the value of the permanent fund dividend, we're happy to have you do that. There's a huge class of people to which that decision will apply, and therefore it's not an ethics violation for you to work, you know, sort of toward the general common public good. Let me give you maybe a more specific example. If you are if you're in the executive branch and you're contemplating the route for the pipeline, for the gas pipeline, and you believe it's going to benefit, say, Delta Junction, and you own property in Delta Junction, that's probably not an ethics violation because there's an enormous class of people that also live in Delta Junction whose homes will increase and their property will increase in value. So in general, that would not be an ethics violation. You could imagine a situation in which you're steering that pipeline maybe right toward your own personal property, towards a bridge crossing, for example, or a creek crossing where you have access and they're going to have to buy your personal property, and that'd be different. But in general, if economic development is going to increase all the value of homes in a community and you're one of those community members, that probably wouldn't be an Ethics Act violation. On page 2, the list continues. Line 2 says, if your personal interest is insignificant, personal interests are different than financial interests. They are just that. There's no money involved. You may have some personal interest in what's going on in the decision being made, but if it's insignificant, if it's small and not large, it's not really well defined. We looked at trying to define it better, but it's one of those areas where it's very difficult to render in words. So we left it alone since it hadn't been a problem. And then subsection C is the real meat, if you will, of the CES. And that's a list, a lengthy and I think a fairly comprehensive list of the types of business interests that impinge on the ownership interest you might have in a company. And it sets out a series of 8 disqualifying interests that would keep you from being able to take official action with respect to your business. For example, if you own a controlling interest in the business and the controlling interest has a fair market value of $5,000 or more, you can't take official action. And so on, all through down the list, and I think it's fairly self-explanatory. That's section 1, and maybe it's worth it to Mr. Chairman to stop and take questions on that section since the next section is not not thematically linked to the first one.
Well, I would rather prefer just to go through the bill.
As you mentioned,
we'll come back because there's some overlying issues with the different sections and how things jump around, but if you could just...
As you wish, Mr. Chairman. The section 2 has to do with a recurring problem or issue, if you will, in our line of work in that people transfer out of the public sector into the private sector, and they do so sometimes to go and lobby. The section 2, as it's written, tightens up the numbers of individuals, the job titles of the individuals that can leave public office and go to work for a private firm and begin lobbying. The former ban was on governors, lieutenant governors, heads of departments may not engage in an activity as a lobbyist for 1 year, period. We've now broadened that to say governor, lieutenant governor, head, or deputy head, or division directors, or employees of the Office of Governor in a policy-making position, or the chair of a state board or commission that has the authority to adopt regulations, all of that universe now of individuals may not leave state service and begin lobbying for a period of 1 year, no matter what the topic of the lobbying effort is. There's some confusion, I think, between this provision and subsection A of the same statute. Subsection A is the provision that keeps you from lobbying on a matter in which you made decisions as a public employee. And that's a 2-year prohibition. But we've frequently seen that prohibition gotten around, if you will, because people say, well, I didn't work on that matter, I'm lobbying on a different matter, and they step right out of the governor's office or right out of the attorney general's office and begin lobbying on behalf of companies with slightly unrelated interests. So this is a blanket ban for 1 year on this list of individuals from lobbying on any topic, period. Finally, Section 3 on page 3, simply broadens the definition of official action. The Rehnquist case a couple of years ago pointed out that there were some weaknesses in this definition. There was some question as to whether stock trading and making decisions during the course of your day was official action. And we've tried to broaden official action to pretty much pick up almost everything you do while you're seated in a state office building in a state chair in front of a state desk with a state computer at your side. If you're doing something in that milieu, chances are it's official action. And that's an overview of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator French. Section 1, line 17, one of the things that we're going to look at here in the next couple of days is consistency issues. And throughout these bills, there's terms used, public officer and public officials. And I'd like to know what do you think those terms mean, and are we being consistent? And I recognize we haven't heard of, you know, bill number 20 coming at us, but the question is, Coyne, are we being consistent not only within Senate Bill 19, but are we being consistent throughout our, you know, our chapters 45, 60, 50, and 52, which are,
Mr. Chairman,
our lobbying, our standards of conflict, our public office, financial disclosure, and ethics branch, ethics act. You know, so there's consistency and less likely to find loopholes.
Mr. Chairman, just as a point of order, I thought I heard you say section 1, line 17.
Excuse me, 7.
So you're on line 7, and are you asking about the use of the term public officer?
Correct. And public official is also used in and around those different chapters. I'm just wondering what you feel they mean, and are we being consistent in the uses of those definitions?
I guess on that point, I would defer to someone from the Department of Law who may have more awareness of the litigation and the, you know, development of those terms in court. My view is that they're synonymous, but that may be erroneous. It may be that there's a term of art and definitional, you know, aspect to those two phrases that I'm not aware of.
Maybe we'll go to Dan Wayne on legal services. I think he might be able to respond to that question. Is he online?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear the question, and could you please respond?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if I may. The term public officer is used in 3952, which is the Executive Branch Ethics Act. Public officer covers state employees, members of boards or commissions. Just a second, refer to my book here.
And then, Mr. Wayne, could you please identify yourself for the record? And we also have joined us Senator Elton and Senator Dyson.
Yes, my name is Dan Wayne. I'm legislative legal counsel. I've worked on drafting of this bill, and my last name is spelled W-A-Y-N-E. As I was saying, Mr. Chairman, 3952.965 is the definition section for the Alaska Executive Branch Ethics Act. And definition number 21 defines public officer or officer as a public employee, a member of a board or commission, and a state officer designated by the governor to act as trustee. So public employee is also defined as including permanent, probationary, seasonal, temporary, provisional, or non-permanent employees of an agency in the classified, partially exempt, or exempt service. Obviously, that wouldn't include some of the folks in the governor's office, governor, lieutenant governor, I'm not sure who else, but it would include a large number of state employees. Public official is defined in 3950-200, and it's a long definition, but it's basically it's a list of a pretty comprehensive list of high-ranking elected or appointed public officials, including judicial officers and appointed or elected municipal officers, and then a whole range of state directors, department heads, the governor, lieutenant governor are on here, members of the board of trustees, the executive director, et cetera, of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And then it lists the chair or a member of a state commission or board. And it goes on in a B section of that, of the definitions, to list all what state commission or board means. And it lists, 58 different boards and commissions. And they're mostly of the type that don't appear in 08, 01, 010, which is another list of boards and commissions that look to me to be mostly to deal with licensing issues and things like that. The type of boards and commissions that appear in 3950-200 would be the include the State Council on the Arts, the Board of Parole, the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, the Board of Fisheries, Board of Game. Boards and commissions that have regulatory authority and regularly make law, I guess, would be one of the things that they seem to have in common.
So I guess the fundamental question, are we consistent?
Well,
or not?
You try to be internally consistent in a bill, but it doesn't mean that everything in a bill is necessarily consistent with the rest of the chapter that it's in. Obviously, there's the term public officer is used in some places, and the term public official is used in other places, and I think they have probably have the meaning that's given in these definitions. And it would be a policy call as to whether or not the legislature wants to use one definition or the other. They don't mean the same thing at all.
Okay, thank you. Before I open up the question of the committee, I got a couple more issues I want to get on the table. In section two, and there's a handout that of the statutes, and Senator French had alluded to it on 52-180, section A. It covers most people. And can we have a little further explanation, Senator French, on the differences between section A and section D? And then in section A, if why the legislate, why there's a legislative exemption. I mean, I'm not really sure that section D isn't used to trump section A and people get around section A.
I think your instinct is correct, Mr. Chairman. I think of the two sections, section D is the more powerful. It's the more blanket prohibition. Section D says you may, on line 28, you may not engage in activity as a lobbyist for a period of 1 year, period. If we go back to section A, and I'm assuming everybody has this handout that I was helpfully provided. It's a copy of the statute. Section A says a public officer who leaves state service may not for 2 years after leaving state service represent, advise, or assist a person for compensation. Now, this is broader than lobbying. This is, sort of working on behalf of, if you will, regarding a matter that was under consideration by the administrative unit served by that public officer, in which the officer participated personally and substantially through the exercise of official action. And then it goes on to define matter to include a case, proceeding, application, contract, determination, et cetera. So this is, this prohibits you, I guess in my interpretation is Section A prohibits you for trading on the information that you gleaned and the work that you did as a public officer. You can't take that special knowledge, and moreover, you can't, you know, sort of capitalize on having made a decision which may have benefited one side or another in a dispute or one company over another in a contract proceeding. You can't capitalize on that decision-making power that you had as a public officer and jump over and begin to work for that same entity for compensation. It just leaves a bad taste in everyone's mouth and looks bad. It looks like it's, you know, a payback, if you will, for the decision that you made. So just to recap, A is a narrow provision designed to keep you from using the decision-making power you had to perhaps get a job the day you leave state service, whereas D is just a blanket prohibition on lobbying for certain placed individuals, governor, lieutenant governor, and so forth.
I think we'll look at the interplay between these two paragraphs over the next couple of days, and I'm not so sure that, you know, this isn't one of those issues where there's some maneuverability. Concerning legislative staff lobbying, you know, is that after they leave service, is there limitations on that? And if not, should there be?
Well, now just for the moment, we're leaving the executive branch and we're coming over now to our branch. And I think that's one of those areas where we may want to divide the conversation into two conversations, just for the sake of clarity, Mr. Chairman, because I think it's a worthwhile inquiry. I think it's an inquiry that absolutely has to happen, but it may, it's always, at least in my mind, it's hard to keep executive and legislative separate, because we tend to take them all up as one big question. But I guess I just caution us into going down that road right at the moment.
We can come back to that. That is an issue we need to address. Let's go ahead and open it up. Senator Dyson, you had flagged up a question, then Senator Thomas, and then Senator Elton, after we hear from Senator Hoffman, if he has any questions.
No questions here, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you. Senator Hall French, in the section talking about, in essence, the officials' holdings, was there any discussion about somebody that gets appointed to a position and has some large holdings and they take and put it in a blind trust or make it, you know, available in their children, their estate or their children's stuff, some way to take that wealth and position that they've had for a long time and put it out of their reach and influence so that they can do their job with integrity?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, the blind trust question is one of those pure policy calls that I will leave to the, you know, wisdom of the committee. My own personal view is that a blind trust is a solution that's not as good as the solutions that's here. These are more stringent, I believe. For maybe the public who's listening, a blind trust works like this. I get hired as an attorney general or as a high officer. I have $1 million worth of IBM stock. I turn that over to put it in a blind trust. And from that point over, I can't be sure if that IBM stock is still owned by me or if it's been traded away into something else. But I may have some idea that a prudent stockbroker wouldn't trade a million shares of IBM stock away in the first 6 months of my tenure, that they might trade that slowly. They may decide to keep a hold of it. And so in the back of my mind, I think I still have an allegiance to that stock that's in a blind trust. And so I think it makes suspicious any decisions I make during my time as a public official with respect to IBM or with respect to similar investments that I may own. And so to my mind, it's not as good a solution as this solution, which just says you have to make a decision. Do you want to own a bunch of IBM stock, or do you want to take official action on behalf of computer companies that may have business with them?
Follow up?
And a different question on the same subject. So the, let's say the official is doing their duty, and in the midst of the discussions that come up, some technicians or technical expert says, you know, we understand that the best way of drying pulp is to use the process developed by Company X, and the official sitting there thinking, I think I own stock in that. You know, what should an official do when in that kind of a circumstance?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think the answer is to be careful not to take official action. First go look and go, you know, be careful not to take official action with respect to that investment, and to recuse yourself or to ask some other official to make the decision or take the action on your behalf. But I think one of the things to keep in mind when you're dealing especially with executive branch ethics is that there's thousands of state employees, and there's bound to be another one that can come in and make that decision for you and take over. That's why it's important to keep legislative ethics separate, because there's only 60 of us, and so it's just a little more difficult sometimes for us to be interchangeable. But in the executive branch, we assume that it's a full-time job that pays a living wage, and B, there's probably somebody else that can make the decision for you.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, mine was not a question. It was more of a comment, and so I'll not take up the time at this point, since we're going to be refining some of this a little bit. Thank you, though.
Mr. Allen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And a point, another point of clarification for me. On line 25, page 2, in section 2, we use the term principal department. And I guess I'm wondering whether that's a cabinet department, and if not, whether it covers things like HFC or ADA. I don't know what principal department means.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I will defer to Dan Wayne. This was an amendment that we added in state affairs. The idea was to get division directors, because of their, you know, sort of superior policymaking abilities in those positions. And so we did it, if you will, on the fly in state affairs. And so if I may, I'll defer to him.
Mr. Dan Wayne, are you still online?
Yes, I am.
I
think that the legislature has established principal departments in state government. Each one, we recognize it as it has a commissioner. It has, you know, it's charged with certain duties. I don't know if the term is defined. I can try to look here and get back to you in a second, but I think there's kind of a common understanding of what principal department means.
Okay, we can come back to you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And a second question, and I'm going to use an example, and it's back to section 1 and the bright line of $1,000. And I'm going to use myself as an example, even though I recognize this is an executive branch bill. I have SBS, and I'm lucky to have it, and I'm lucky to have had an accumulation over a period of time in SBS. I also have mutual funds through Charles Schwab. I mean, with this bright line, I'm assuming it would be my responsibility to add up whatever might be in my Charles Schwab account and whatever might be in my SBS account and determine whether or not I've reached the bright line of $5,000. Is that a correct statement?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, my answer is yes. I think that's right. Although I think particularly mutual funds and, you know, sort of commingled funds where it's not an individual stock ownership, my own view is that it'd be hard to make out a positive charge of an Ethics Act violation because you owned, you know, say $100,000 of a mutual fund, and the principal holding is, you know, Berkshire Hathaway or Google or IBM even. And so it may be that, you know, you've got $5,000 worth of IBM stock, but in my view, you know, we're now at the outer fringes of, you know, an Ethics Act violation.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I had a couple more questions earlier, but Senator Elton really raised a question. I have very carefully made sure that I don't know what stocks my SBS owns or the guy that's managing my investments for me, because I don't want, and I've instructed them both, don't tell me, because I don't want to know. And does that help my ethical position? If I get accused, it's an argument based on my declaring ignorance.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I guess I would ask for Mr. Wayne to comment on this as well, but my view is that it's strict liability. My view is that there's no knowledge element here, that you either do or do not own the stock or own the interest, and so there's not, you know, we don't inquire into your state of mind. We don't inquire into whether you knew it or not. Yeah. But okay. Maybe Mr. Wayne has another view of that.
Yeah, one follow-up?
It's on a separate subject.
Okay, we'll just refer then to Mr. Wayne, if you could. Are you ready, Mr. Wayne?
Yes, I'm ready.
Go ahead.
I don't have anything to add to what the point that Senator French made. I agree that there's no knowledge requirement. That it's a strict, you know, either you have it or you don't, and regardless of your knowledge. Back to the question about principal departments, if I may, Mr. Chairman. It actually, the language comes from the Alaska Constitution, Article 3, the executive branch, which talks about, it uses the term principal department. It says that there will be 20 principal departments, or no more than 20 principal departments, and that regulatory, quasi-judicial, and temporary agencies can be established by law and don't need to be allocated within a principal department. So that's why we have some, there's other agencies that don't fall within principal departments.
Okay, just a second. David Jones is online from the Department of Law. Are you?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm here in person.
Oh, excuse me. We'll bring you up here in a minute then. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, so if the implication then from both your testimony, Senator French, and the gentleman who just spoke, is that every time the guy that's managing my accounts, and he's making transactions every day, he needs to call me almost instantaneously so that I'm very sure of what stocks my account owns, just in case there might be some action that I'm taking here that might produce a conflict of interest. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think that's right. Although it may be, you know, I think the stock issues are interesting questions because they're easy to measure what the stock amounts are, but it may be worthwhile to hear from someone from the governor's office about the number of state employees who actually make decisions during their day-to-day work that affect stocks.
Yeah, no, thanks for pointing out that it's a difference in the executive branch here. On a technical question, on your bill, page 1, line 11, I don't have your skill or experience with legal language crafting, but I wondered why at the end of that sentence it said or instead of and. Because it seems to me that you could go down through that laundry list, and as long as you're innocent on one, you're good. It seemed to me it should have been an accumulative.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, actually this is one of the more entertaining conversations I've had in my office recently, because we worked through the logic chain of this, and you're right. Any one of these will absolve you, and if you and the reason is if you work through each of the prongs, you'll find that if one of those is true, then it must be okay what you've done. And let me just use the first prong as an example. If the, and this is now for everyone else, we're on page 1, lines 10 and 11. If your action or influence in the matter would only have an insignificant effect on the matter, it's okay if you have $1 billion worth of stock. If the action that you took doesn't affect the stock, you're absolved if the action you took doesn't affect that interest, because we just decide as a policy that it doesn't matter. And that's why there's not an and. That's why there's an or. And you can go on down the list and see that each one of those, if that's true, you're absolved from wrongdoing. But it took about four of us 10 minutes to figure it out in my office, so don't feel bad.
Well, I'm comforted. Last thing, have you seen this report?
Sorry, I'm going back and forth in glasses.
It's the Better Government Association.
I don't think I have.
And they rank states on integrity and corruption.
I've not seen it, through the chair.
Yeah, and we can make them available to you. It ranks Alaska as the 23rd out of the 50 states, and it deals with the following subjects. Having to do with corruption, Freedom of Information Act, whistleblower protection, campaign finance, gifts, trips, and honoraria, conflicts of interest, you know, and so on. And pretty interesting. We rank the lowest on freedom of information. We're pretty good on conflict of interest, a 95th percentile, according to this. And then it goes on to quote Department of Justice reports saying that we're the sixth most corrupt state in the nation. And pretty interesting. But if you're interested, I'll make this stuff available to you. But it certainly makes me think about the fact that maybe we're not attacking the real heart of the issues, or that there are more issues that we ought to be considering in our ethics legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any comments, Senator French? I'd like to call up David Jones, Department of Law. You could please stay there, maybe, if you want, or don't go far anymore.
We'll just be right there, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You could please identify yourself and.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Jones. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law out of the Anchorage office. My last name is spelled J-O-N-E-S. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Law just to make a couple comments about the committee substitute for Senate Bill 19. As you may know, the governor has introduced a bill addressing some ethics issues. It's Senate Bill 64. Some of the issues addressed in the governor's bill are also addressed in Senate Bill 19. Just looking at Senate Bill 19, I thought it worth pointing out that on page 2, lines 6 and 7, would make it disqualifying for a member of the executive branch to have a controlling interest in a business only if the value of that controlling interest was $5,000 or more. However, also on page 2, in lines 9 and 12 and 13, an executive branch member's interest in a business involving stock, options to buy stock, equity, or options to buy equity would be disqualifying if it were only 1% of the value of the entire business, regardless of the total value of that 1% interest. So, for example, if I had a 1% interest in a business that's worth $1,000, I have a $10 interest, but that's disqualifying under the latter two provisions. Section 1 of the of Senate Bill 19 addresses the definition of significance in terms of the Executive Branch Ethics Act for interests in businesses. The governor's bill, Senate Bill 64, uses different language to achieve a similar result in Section 8 of that bill, which appears on page 6, lines 25 and 26 of the governor's bill. Section 2 of Senate Bill 19 deals with the restrictions on lobbying after leaving state service. As Senator French pointed out, currently those restrictions apply to the governor, lieutenant governor, and heads of principal departments. The governor has also proposed in Section 11 of the governor's bill to extend these lobbying restrictions to include additional folks, particularly
deputy commissioners and those in policymaking positions in the governor's office. Section 19 extends it a bit further to some others. I agree with Mr. Wayne in answering your question, Mr. Chairman, about the difference between public officials and public officers and how those terms are used in Title 39, Chapter 50, and Title 39, Chapter 52. In the Executive Branch Ethics Act, they use the term public officers, and that means executive branch folks, public employees in the executive branch, and members of boards and commissions. Public officials includes many more folks, and that's the term that is used in the financial disclosure provisions in Title 39, Chapter 50. And they include, as Mr. Wayne noted, not only executive branch people, but also judicial officers and some municipal officers. And I do believe that we've been consistent in the use of those two terms. They don't mean the same thing. They're used in different contexts to mean different things. You had a question earlier, Mr. Chair, about the difference between Section A of 3952-180 and Section B. Section A of 3952-180 is a general restriction that applies to all public employees. And it applies for 2 years, and it prohibits them, after they leave state service, from receiving compensation to work on any matter in which they personally and substantially participated during their state employment. The Part B that Senate Bill 19 would amend just applies to certain public officials, not all executive branch officers, and that restricts lobbying for 1 year. And that's one of the differences between the two. Section A applies to everybody, applies for 2 years, and covers only those things in which the employee or officer was personally and substantially involved, whereas subsection B applies to any type of lobbying for 1 year, but is restricted currently to the governor, lieutenant governor, and heads of principal departments. And I agree with Senator French. We went through the same sort of analysis, trying to be sure that or was the correct choice on page one. And we agree that or is the choice rather than and. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Elton.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jones, for your presentation. I'm just wondering if you could comment a little bit on the governor's approach to principal department. As an example, the head of AHFC and some of the officers at AHFC are arranging multi-million dollar financial packages with Goldman Sachs or somebody else. I mean, under this language or under the language proposed by the governor, would there be a prohibition from those officers in AHFC, for example, to lobby for Goldman Sachs?
No, there would not. The only way they'd be prohibited would be under Section A of 180, if they were lobbying on a matter in which they were personally and substantially involved during their state employment. But that lobbying restriction, as it now exists, and as the governor proposes amending it, and I believe as Senate Bill 19 would amend it, would not apply to the head of AHFC.
So if I could continue, just to put a finer point on it. So the only restriction would be if they were lobbying on behalf of a financial transaction that may have already taken place, but not a potential financial transaction in which Goldman Sachs might be interested.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I don't think that's the only situation. It would have to be a matter with which they dealt during their state service personally and substantially. And that may well occur only when the transaction's already completed. But I suspect there may be situations in which the transaction is ongoing when the state service ends.
Okay, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think this is something that I'm, I'll talk to the prime sponsor about and see if we can't get some kind of language that may address that problem or that issue. Thanks, Mr.
Senator Hoffman. We're going to be wrapping up this bill here pretty quick and go on to the next one so we don't run out of time. But Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You stated in Section 2 that this particular piece of legislation expands the coverage of individuals that are have to comply, and I was wondering, does the governor's office support this expansion or oppose the expansion of the coverage?
I am not in a position to give the governor's office's position on this particular expansion. I haven't received instructions or been consulted about that, so I can't answer it, and I apologize.
Well, will we get an answer before we take action on this?
Through the chair, Senator Hufkin, I can make sure that happens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, with that, I'd like Senator French to come forward and wrap up any comments he has on committee substitute for Senate Bill 19, and we're going to go on to Senate Bill 20. And we're going to hold both these bills for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll defer wrap-up comments. I think the discussion's been ample, and I'd be happy to answer any follow-up questions that may have arisen from you or any other members of the committee.
Okay. We'll set this bill aside then. We're going to go on to Senate Bill 20. Senate Bill 20 concerns disclosures by the legislature, executive employees, public members of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. And Senator French, if you could kind of give us an overview and go into the details of the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 20, and the document I'm working on is CS for Senate Bill 20, State Affairs / Kilo, K. Deals with the disclosures and the information that we as legislators and other legislative employees provide to the public to let them know what it is that we're doing when we're not here in the Capitol working on their behalf, what we're doing to earn a living outside the Capitol, who we're working for, how much they're paying us, and what amounts of effort we're having to put out to gain that employment. I'll take you through the bill section by section. Section 1, you can see the amendments there on lines 11 and 12 are simply cleanup language suggested by the Department of Law to make that provision read more fluidly. And so the bill more or less begins on page 2, section 2, adds a new section that requires disclosure of from a legislator, legislative employee, or public member after the final day of service. There's been a bit of a loophole and a bit of a question about when you have to file your last APOC report when you leave office. And this just makes it clear that you have to file 90 days after your final day of service. There's been some question about whether you had to file, for example, Mr. Chairman, we serve your 4-year term of office. My 4-year term of office ends in the middle of January after the calendar year after an election. And so, for example, this year there were members whose last day of service was January 14th or 15th, whatever day it was that some folks were, the rest of us were sworn in 2007. It wasn't clear whether they had to file a report for that short little window of time, those 2 weeks of January, and if so, when they have to do so. It was also sometimes not clear if you had to file after you left service for one reason or other, whether you resigned or for whatever reason you left service, or if you were a legislative employee, you simply went from one job to another. And so this just wraps up that you have to do so within 90 days after you leave. And it's our hope, of course, that this just makes it uniform. Section 3 makes some amendments, and this is more or less the heart of the bill. Section 3 makes some amendments to the disclosures and the types of disclosures that we as legislators and the public members of the Ethics Committee and legislative directors have to make. And the real changes are, begin on line 18 and go down from there. You have to disclose not only income in excess of $1,000, but also dividends in excess of $1,000 if you receive them from a limited liability company. There was some issue about whether that was actually income or closing the question by making it explicit that that's income, just like the income referred to in on line 17. Skipping on down to lines 21 through 22, in the past you had to describe the nature of the services performed. Sometimes that was just a one or two word description, and so we're just fleshing that out to make it clear that you have to describe it with sufficient description to make it clear to a person of ordinary understanding the specific services performed. Lines 24 and 25 require you to disclose the number of hours you put in performing those services. And the reason we do that is that it's just, I think, a simple method for the public to use in gauging how much effort you're putting out in exchange for the money that you're getting. You know, it may be if you're you know, getting a $20,000 contract, it may be that you've only put out 10 hours, in which case, you know, eyebrows, I think, would legitimately be raised about, you know, the nature of the business relationship. On the other hand, if you're working, you know, 5 40-hour weeks in exchange for $20,000, the public might say, well, this is a person who's getting compensated at a normal rate that we can, you know, compare to other CPAs or lawyers or, you know, what, you know, plumbers even, whatever it is you're doing in exchange for the money and the amount of work you're putting out. And finally, on line 26, we require the amount of income received from the source if the recipient is a legislator or legislative director. The old standards about whether the person giving you the money was known to have legislative business is being put by the wayside, so that it's just, you don't have to answer that question. You don't have to worry about whether the person that gave you the money is a lobbyist or someone that might have some, you know, legislative business before the legislature. You simply report the amount of money you receive, and that's far more simple. And finally, section 4 clears up who to whom it applies. Section 2 of the Act applies to a person serving as a legislator who leaves service on or after the effective date of the Act, and to a person who's not a legislator but served as a legislator between April 2006 and the effective date of the Act. And then Section B says a person who is not a legislator on the effective date of this Act, but who served as a legislator between April 6, 2006 and the effective date, shall make the disclosure required within 90 days after the effective date of the Act. It just makes it apply to basically to everybody. So those are the provisions of the bill, and thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer questions.
When we look at page 2, line 18, it's pretty clear we're talking about dividend income from a limited liability company in excess of $1,000. But isn't the real point we're trying to drive at is that if a legislator has any remuneration, wealth creation of in excess of $1,000, if it's through a dividend or through some form of a derivative of a deferred compensation, stock options, any other mechanism that they may embed in that limited liability company, that the public should have should know about that, and we should disclose it. So we as the public and other legislators have a clear understanding of compensation, when and how it's not only created, but where it's created from. And is this language tight enough to accomplish that, if that's what we're trying to do?
Mr. Chairman, I'll agree that the idea is disclosure, and agree that you know, the object of the bill is to let the public know what it is we're doing for the money we earn outside the legislature. As long as we're a citizen legislature, we've got to earn money. Most of us have to earn money, you know, in our off time. And I guess I'll defer to your, you know, sort of greater financial acumen with respect to the different sorts of ways that people can get money. We're just trying to capture, you know, the ones that we're aware of, or the types of income that have been problems in the past, and address those problems. And it sounds as if you have a more sort of forward-looking approach to the idea and approach to the problem, and I'm obviously eager to hear better ways of defining the problem.
Well, we can look at that over the next couple of days and see if there's something in that language we can work on a little bit, just to, you know, so we don't have an opportunity that there's could possibly be some financial gain made that someone feels that they don't have to disclose for whatever reason. I think the more you disclose, the better. Senator Hoffman, do you have any questions?
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And once again, back to Section 3, lines 18 and 19. I recognize that a very large number of companies registered in the state of Alaska are limited liability companies. But are there other types of business entities that also pay dividends? And are we restricting this just to the limited liability companies?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, again, we should probably hear from some of the legal drafters and the more honed legal minds on the question. But you know, my view is income in excess of $1,000 sort of covers almost everything. And then what we learned was that it didn't cover a dividend from a limited liability company. And whether there's a third category or a third exception, if someone brings it to my attention, I'd be more than eager to write a provision that covered that. But I can't capture it right now.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator French, as I recall, wasn't it Senate Bill 20 that also had the provision of professional licensing?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it did have that, and it was removed in the Judiciary Committee. Yes.
Good. In that respect, I think it would be of some interest to the committee so they understood what we did and the ramifications of it. And, you know, I supported that proactively, but it may fall into one of the categories of being very onerous, but I don't know. Can you help us out on that?
Thank you. Through the chair and Senator Huggins, what Senator Huggins is referring to is it is a delicate issue with respect to some professions, because this, keep in mind that this will require all of us to disclose our clients and the amount of money that our clients gave us, no matter what profession you fall in, whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, a plumber, or whatever it is that you do outside the legislature. And there was some concern, and I think the other body's wrestling with this question as well. There's some concern about whether an attorney, for example, should be disclosing his or her clients and the amount of money received, because attorneys like doctors and other professional folks, investment advisors, sometimes help people with problems that they don't want the world to know about. And we wrestle with the idea of keeping some professions from having to disclose a detailed description of the nature of the services performed, because we felt that the broader term, say attorney services, was sufficiently descriptive to let the public know what was being provided. Upon committee discussion and upon greater reflection, you know, we came to a policy decision there, which, you know, obviously this committee is free to revisit, if you want to participate in the legislature, if you want to be a legislator, it may be that you can't take certain types of work outside these halls. It may be that I, as an attorney, shouldn't be doing sensitive patent work for Alaska clients, because I'll have to disclose the fact that they came to me for a patent application. And that's just the trade-off, if you will. That's the balance that you have to strike between public service and private remuneration. So it's a balance, and we struck it in favor of openness. I think it's the right balance, but there may be, you know, perhaps some types of doctors or may need exemption. Although I should add, I guess just while I wrap up, is our understanding is that there are superseding federal laws which would probably trump this one with respect to a doctor. It may be that a doctor would before he or she divulges his or her clients, say, sorry, I can't do that because of privacy statutes. The HIPAA statute is the one I've got in mind when you're filling out your APOC disclosures. So I hope that wasn't too long-winded.
Senator Huggins, you have a follow-up?
Well, if I might, just as a comment, I didn't ask Senator French to discuss that for us to repeal it because I was a supporter of it. It's a fairly extensive list, though, and it might be of interest to people. I didn't bring it with me. I think it's about 38, and one of them has to do with performing arts, as an example, and promoters of events. So it's a pretty, but under the category, it just had a carve-out that everybody evidently had just assumed was okay if you had a state or a federal license. It just carved you out from having to. And I thought it was very important that we not have that carve out, and I still support it. So,
Senator Dyson.
Thank you. This whole subject very interesting and very convoluted. Did you, in your deliberations, consider expanding the list of service providers for whom the confidentiality of their clients is protected?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, maybe you can be more specific about the sorts of individuals you have in mind or the professions you have in mind.
Well, my wife's a mental health counselor, and every year we go through the drill of the demand is that she give a list of all of her clients, and every year we go through the drill of she writes, you know, a document that says that that's protected information and she can't and won't declare it. And I think that attorneys are under the same protection for their clients, and some medical doctors are. And I remember when we had a member of the legislature who had a very large insurance business, and he chose not to continue service because he wanted to protect the privacy of his clients. And so those are the kind of things I'm thinking about.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think my review of the subject is that doctors have fairly explicit protection through federal statutes about revealing who their clients are. I think the lawyer question is a more narrow and a tougher issue. I think there you could get conflicting opinions about that, about whether the attorney-client privilege really covers your identity, for example. As soon as I take a client, as soon as I file a court filing on that client's behalf, it's public information. My name's on the document, the client's name's on the document, it's public information. So clearly it's been waived to that extent, the identity of the client, and really the nature of their legal problem is laid out in that court filing. Whether that applies to a pure consultation, whether that applies to someone coming to me and saying, you know, look, my son has a drug problem, the police are after him, or I'm going through a nasty divorce, or whatever, you know, whatever personal issue that you know, is brought to the attorney. Again, it may be that my view is that more disclosure is better than less, and it may be that a country lawyer or a family lawyer or a lawyer who takes all kinds of cases says to their clients when they come in, you understand I'm a legislator, you understand I'm going to have to disclose your identity and at least some description of the legal services you're seeking me for, sometime next year. And it may be that you'll lose some business. It may be that most folks, and I think my sort of inner sense is that most folks probably wouldn't care that was being disclosed. Go ahead.
Well, so hypothetically, let's say you and your son decide to open a shop that does mountain guiding.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And so as I understand this, if a client pays you and your son's company $1,000, you've got to declare that the name of that person that you did guiding for. And so anybody that comes to you and says, I want you to take us up in the Brooks Range, you got to declare it, correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Yeah. And so, and then supposing that you did some guiding in the Chugach State Park, then every time an action comes up before the legislature that affects the operation of the Chugach State Park, would you think that you'd need to declare a conflict of interest, or at least put on the record that you got a dog in that fight?
Through the chair, I think that's right, although I think that's current law. If when we take up real estate questions, I make a disclosure that I'm a landlord in Anchorage and that it may impact my investment. My vote may have some effect on my investment.
Okay, thank you. Do we need to wrap up? Any other questions? You want to wrap up 20, and we'll try to bring 19 and 20 back at the same time so we kind of work these two bills together for the ease of the committee. But do you have any closing comments or Senator Frank?
I just think I think the questions have been good, and I think it is important to keep in mind that 20 is a fairly significant expansion of the obligation that we have as legislators to disclose to the public our sources of income. I think we shouldn't overlook the fact that this is going to be more difficult. Now, I can just close by saying, in my example, I'm a landlord. I have 24 tenants. I'll have to disclose not only the names of the tenants, but the exact amount of income I receive from each one, which is something new. And I'll also have to disclose the number of hours I did to provide each apartment dweller with their apartment. And I think it adds to our obligations, but I think it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
That we're going to go ahead and set Senate Bill 20 aside. There's no further business from the committee. We're going to go ahead and adjourn on. We'll be back on with the base student formula explanation on Friday. It's going to be an hour.
Wallace.
If we can just hold for a second. I don't think, we'll just go to Nettie's. Record here. Anyway, we're gonna go over the student formula. We could. Back on the record. We're going to take up the base student formula on Friday. We're going to have a short time frame. We're going to look at, so we'll have a presentation by the Department of Ed, and then we'll have the schedule out coming up for the next week. We're going to look at moving the time of starting on Friday a little earlier, because we, with an hour meeting on Friday, to get to the floor, things get a little tight. So we might start rolling it forward. Again, we're gonna try to start right on time. And just for the procedure of the committee, again, there's seven of us here, so we'll have a question and then a follow-up question, and then we're gonna roll around the committee to try to get everybody's questions on the table. And then when we have time allotted, we'll come back to the individual members that have more questions. So just because you don't get a series of four questions answered in a row, I'm just trying to facilitate the other members of the committee to a smooth process. And we'll try to get all of the questions answered. If we run out of time, we'll try to set things aside so we can have the individual senators get with the bill sponsors and we can get our information of whatever detail each of us want to have, so we're comfortable to take action on whatever bills before us. So that's the process that we're going to run under. I think it should work fairly well as we get busy. There'll be days when we'll run a little informal because we may have a one bill hearing or something like that. With that, this meeting's adjourned.